Welcome to the second hour of the Mike Novak Show. I'm glad you're with me. I'm devoting this entire second hour to the One Earth Film Festival 2015 in Chicago from March 6th to 8th. I talked to a bunch of great people, including the director of one of the films, and I hope you stick around for those conversations. Okay, here we are on one of the coldest days of the year.
And we'll be setting records, apparently, today and tomorrow in February. But we're gearing up for March. And the fourth annual One Earth Film Festival 2015, which is going to run Friday to Sunday, March 6th through 8th. And with Cassandra West and Gina Robbins and David Holmquist from the One Earth Film Festival, thank you all for being here today. Cassandra, let's start with you because you and I have talked about this before. Fourth annual, that means obviously it's working. Tell me a little bit of the kinds of films you like to bring in.
Well, we started this 4 years ago with the idea of informing people what's happening in our environment, and we focus on energy, transportation, conservation, a lot of films on water, food, all of the things that impact our life and the environment around us.
That simple, right?
It's that simple, yeah. And I think we're trying to get people to focus on what's happening around them. Sometimes, you know, in our day-to-day life, we're just not paying attention, and there are a lot of issues that really are critical and we should be aware of. And so this is an educational, it's not so much an entertainment component, but film is a way to, it does have a creative entertainment.
Okay, let me stop you right there, though. Okay, I'm a radio guy who talks about these issues all the time. And what I tell people is if my show's not entertaining, nobody's going to pay any attention to it. Mm-hmm. All right. You're saying it's not necessarily an entertainment value here, but these films have to be good. They have to be entertaining on some level.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, you wouldn't bring them in, right?
Absolutely. I wouldn't want to put entertainment at the top because this is not to... but yes, there's the entertainment value because the people who create these films are creative types, and they've looked at some of the issues that are very critical in a way that makes people think about them. So obviously they have to be creative and thoughtful.
I'm going to, again, go back to the idea that it's got to be entertaining. It's got to be more than informative. And sometimes information is entertaining. All right, you talk about this being grassroots. How is that grassroots? Is it, Cassandra, you said that people bring films to you, but you also seek out films. How does the process work?
Well, the festival itself is largely volunteer run, so it's grassroots in that everybody is giving their time and their resources to make this happen, and it's been like that from the start. We are really fortunate to have great sponsors who are also supporting the effort, and I think we have some interns that might be on staff this year and last year. But for the most part, it's people in the community who care about these issues and want to get the messages out there in a very different format. There's a number of environmental film festivals that happen worldwide, but up until this one, there hasn't really been one in the Midwest, in Chicago.
Really?
So
it's kind of surprising.
Yes, yes, it was surprising. And so we're really fortunate to be forging the road in this way and to have so many people in the community interested and involved in participating in a grassroots way.
And you're involved in Oak Park, River Forest, other communities. You're going to have screenings in a number of places, right?
Oh, absolutely. We've grown much since the first year. Our first year, we were mostly centered or located here in Oak Park and River Forest and a little bit in Austin. And then the next year we branched out, and then we branched out even farther last year. And this year we're going to be the University of Chicago, UIC, Loyola, Columbia College, Elmhurst College, even the Prairie Crossing Charter School in Grays Lake,
Well, let's talk about the films. I mean, that's why we're here. David, you've been the silent one in the room so far.
We reviewed about 150 films that we sought out. Most of them we sought out through film catalogs. We looked at what had been shown in other film festivals over the past year. We tried very hard to get a couple of kind of first-run films. In particular, we tried to get Naomi Klein's, the film adaptation of Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything, which, as it turns out, isn't even ready yet. They had hoped to premiere it at Sundance, but that didn't happen. It's not quite ready yet. Merchants of Doubt is another one that we tried to get, but it conflicted with a theatrical opening at about the same time, so we weren't able to get that. But we found some really terrific films out of the 150 or so, and we go through a process of first review, second review, third review. We try to slot them into the sort of subject areas that Cassandra mentioned, and one that she didn't mention is climate change. So we have a number of good climate change films for this year.
All right, as people who screen these films, what are you looking for when you do this? Because you've obviously, how many films do you think you've looked at this year?
I looked at 40.
40?
40.
that's a lot.
I was a little unusual that way. But
Dedicated, maybe? I don't know.
Well, unusual. But the what we're looking for really is a compelling message. You talked a little earlier about films being entertaining or not.
Yeah.
And entertaining isn't really the criterion. I think what we're looking for is a compelling story.
Okay, compelling, I like that. That's probably a better way of putting it than my ham-fisted way of entertaining. But everything boils down to entertainment because I'm a showbiz guy. Mm-hmm. That those are my origins. Being on the radio is still that. But compelling, yes, that makes sense.
And we look for high production values, no matter where they come from, whether they're low-budget films or higher-budget films. We look for good production values. And we look for something, all of the films have a component of a facilitated discussion afterwards. So we're always looking for films that will prompt, you know, that raise some issues that can form the basis of a discussion after the film.
All right, compelling. Let's start there. And you're watching a film. Are you taking notes, or are you letting it wash over you? What's the process?
I think compelling to me means something that is new. And then, of course, there's nothing new, right? So
right.
Nothing's
exactly
really new. But maybe it's a story is told in a way. You know, I come from a journalism background, so we're always trying to find different ways of telling stories. So how can a story be told? And that's essentially what it is. We're telling the story of our world, of our nature, of our environment. So how can the story be told in a way that gets us to think, gets the wheels in our heads turning in a way that they haven't turned before, to consider something that maybe we take for granted, we see every day and we don't pay attention to and notice? And how has this filmmaker been able to tell this story or present this idea, this concept in a way that is different and gets our attention? So that's what I look for. We screened a film, or I watched a film called Just Eat It, which was shown last night at Loyola's Damon Cinema. It was on food waste. And one of the compelling, to use that term, facts that was presented in that film was that to produce one hamburger, it takes the equivalent of a 90-minute shower. That's the amount of water that it takes to produce one hamburger. Now, I hadn't heard that kind of information anywhere before. That got my attention.
Yeah, so new information that, and I think when I think of compelling, I think that generates action, that makes me as an audience member want to get up and do something about what I'm learning. Another component that we look at is whether the films are solution oriented. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these films will be telling stories about things going wrong in our environment, things that civilization is doing that is affecting the environment in a negative way. And we want to be able to tell a story that this is something that we can do, we as a community can do to make it better. Not all of our films have that component.
I'm sure there's a lot of them.
Some where the message is so compelling that even if a viable solution is not presented, that they're still part of our program. But we do try to incorporate most of our films with some sort of solution.
All right, well, let's get specific. David, you saw 40 films. How many do you figure that you looked at, Gina?
Probably about half that, I think, that I
looked
at
20,
in entirety.
You know?
I mean, I'm looking at the schedule now, and there's about 35 films or 35 films that we're screening this year. And I saw, I think, 8 of them. So
let's talk about some of the films that are going to be here and why they're striking and why you chose them. David?
Do you want to talk about Angel Azul?
Sure. I could talk about Angel Azul. Angel Azul is a film that we're screening at the Lake Theater. We're pre-screening it in advance of the fest as part of the first Tuesday film club on March 3rd. And then it will screen again on March 7th, I think, at the Chicago Cultural Center. Angel Azul is, in fact, a very entertaining film. It's about an artist who is building sculptures underwater to replicate the coral reefs, because there are areas in the Caribbean where tourism is, it's wonderful that people are able to visit the coral reefs, but having so many people interact with it is destroying, is compromising the coral reefs.
Not to mention acidification of the oceans.
Yes, exactly. So what this artist is doing is he has built figurative sculptures that he's placed underwater out of a concrete material that emulates live coral, so that the ocean life will grow on it in the same way that happens in a coral reef. So the director has followed this artist in his process. It's a stunning film. Another interesting thing about the film is in the process, there are things that go wrong because of the way the water is treated. So you learn things that you wouldn't necessarily have expected to learn about water treatment, wastewater treatment, and that effect on the ocean.
Well, through the magic of time, space, Bobby Darin, and recording devices, let us talk to the director of the documentary Angel Azul, and that is Marcy Cravat. I've got a hold of her out in California, and hi there, Marcy. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm fine. Thanks so much for having me.
It's such a pleasure. I saw the film last night, thoroughly enjoyed it, and wanted to talk to you about it. It made me immediately say, yes, let's do it. Let's talk to Marcy about this film, because it's something I probably wouldn't have discovered myself. And I do a lot of environmental reporting. And yeah, I talk about the seas being acidified. I talk about them warming. I talk about all kinds of things. And I started out as an artist, an actor, running a theater company. So I understand how the arts can be brought to play in solving crucial problems that our planet has. And you've done that. You've attempted to do that with your film Angel Azul. Folks should know that well, maybe I should let you explain. How do you start when people say, hey, what's that film you made there? What's that all about? I mean, you've got to have, you've got the elevator speech down by now, I would think.
Yeah. Well, basically, it's a film that merges art and science to deliver a powerful message. And the message turns out to be that everything connects. You know, the film explores the perilous situation that coral reefs are facing around the world. It focuses on the coral reef, the Mesoamerican Barrier Reef, which is down off the coast of the Yucatan. And the artwork, the eco-sculpture done by Jason DeCaries Taylor, who creates artificial coral reefs from statues he's cast from live human models and installed on the ocean floor. And both of these are ways to basically inevitably deliver this message that everything connects. And I feel really strongly about that, and it was more of a discovery, actually. I mean, I knew I always felt that way, but making the film, I didn't really understand that's where I was headed.
Mm-hmm.
But as I continued to film and edit, I realized that's what the film was really about. And it was actually Sylvia Earle's words. She says that herself in the film. And I realized that that's really what all of this effort is about on part of the artist and on my part as a filmmaker.
You know, you've been working on this for too long, because you kind of casually skate by. You talk about coral reefs, and of course, like so many other living elements on this planet, they're under threat. Last week, I talked about the monarch butterfly and how it's disappearing. And how we need to save it. And you talk about coral reefs, but you know what makes me think that you've done this for a very long time is you say, yeah, coral reefs, and there's a guy who's an artist, and he uses sculptures to do the work of the coral reefs. And what folks need to know is that, yeah, this guy's a sculptor, and he's taking these sculptures that where he uses live models to create. And he's putting them in the ocean, on the bottom of the ocean. So
right.
It's and you know, and that whole concept, if I think when people hear that, and you are doing it as a way to protect the reefs that are there, because not only are we polluting the oceans, just our very presence helps destroy these coral reefs, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Unfortunately, our lifestyles and our and the supply and demand, you know, our responsibility in that, you know, all of that affects coral reefs as it does all ecosystems around the world. You know, you don't need to live near the coral reefs to have an effect on them. You know, as you learn in the film, just the way we behave in our lives anywhere contributes to the CO2 emissions and so forth that end up in the ocean. And the ocean is warming up, and a lot of the life in the ocean is dying. And this particular coral reef is the world's second largest coral reef, the Mesoamerican Barrier Reef. And the only other one larger, of course, is the Great Barrier Reef. And the Mesoamerican Barrier Reef is 80% dead, which is a really huge number. That means 20% of it is still living and can still be protected. And this artist, he draws attention to that as well as a lot of other environmental issues, because his statues all have messages, and some of them are very personal messages about the environment to him as a person. You know, he's got one called Inheritance, which is a little boy looking down at his feet, and there's nothing but plastic, you know, around his feet, and it's called Inheritance. There's another one called Inertia, and it's a man sitting on the couch watching TV with a big hamburger and French fries on his plate. You know, so Jason, the artist, he manages to get his own messages out, and at the same time never forget that it's all about the coral reef too for him. You know, that's where he's decided to make these installations, which you're right, it's really unusual. That's what drew me in the first place. The last thing I could have imagined were statues in our human likeness on the bottom of the ocean. It fulfills such a fantasy in a way, and there's such an allure, you know?
And yet, so, you know, what's kind of interesting is that they are lures themselves. We're trying to get people away from the coral reef. Get away from there. Get away from that coral reef and go play with the statues instead.
That was the original intent. When he was hired to go down there and do that work, the original intent was to divert tourists away from the natural reefs. But to be quite honest with you, I don't think anybody had really done their homework, because the real issue that's killing the reef are not the people that are, you know, the tourists that are trampling the reefs, as they would like to believe. I mean, that is a problem, but it's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is the wastewater going into the ocean, either directly being dumped as raw sewage or being deep injected into their aquifer system, which then ends up out on the coral reef. So, yes, they were originally, he was originally brought in there to sort of divert, you know, create a diversion for tourists, but that really didn't solve the problem. The problem would have to be solved by treating their water.
That's very interesting. However, we do have an impact on a lot of things when it comes to our oceans. For one, I've been up to the Pacific Northwest, where at low tide, you can walk around tide pools, and you can see sea anemones and starfish. They're still there because it is national park. They've declared part of the coastline in the Pacific Northwest National Park. However, if you go to California and you walk along the ocean, you won't see any of those because they were picked clean long ago. And that's kind of
it's true that protected, you know, designating part of an ocean area as a protected area is very important. I mean, but in reality, and it does help. If there were lots more of those, that would really, really help. But what I've been told by Dr. Thomas Garreau, who's featured in our film, you know, the sea life doesn't know boundaries, and the, you know, issues of, you know, warming, rising sea levels and warming temperatures are not going to be protected by boundaries, although I'm definitely not saying we don't need those. We do. We need those protected areas and more of them, because there is a huge human impact in overfishing and drilling and testing. You know, yes, we have a horrible impact, and all of these different angles need to be addressed, because the ocean's in real trouble, and it's what we depend on for our own life, you know. And that, I'm not saying that that's the reason why we should do it. I mean, it's one of the reasons. We should just have healthy oceans, because they're beautiful, and there's a lot of living matter and creatures in the ocean that deserve their lives, and we should be doing everything we can to protect what's left, because it's really, really suffering a huge impact right now.
That's Marcy Cravat, who's the director and producer of Angel Azul, the movie. And as a matter of fact, that's the URL for the website, Angel Azul, the movie. And you spell Azul, A-Z-U-L, which means blue in Spanish, which kind of makes sense when you think of the word azure. That would make total sense. But I'm not a Spanish-speaking person. And I was just looking at a graphic that I came across just a few days ago. You were talking about the oceans and what's causing the degradation in the oceans. And the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration put out a graphic several years ago called "Where is Global Warming Going?" And it's got all these dots on it. The atmosphere, continents, glaciers and ice caps, Greenland ice sheet, etc., etc. The ocean is this big blue blob in the middle of this graphic. 93.4% of where global warming is going is the ocean, our oceans all over the planet.
Yeah, that's really, really part of the difficulty of the problem. When CO2, and this actually is a great way to bring up my next film, which is I'm starting to work on now, called Dirt Rich. And it covers basically that CO2 emissions go into the air, and when they're in the air, we have an opportunity to pull those emissions, draw them down, and put them back in the soil. But if we don't do that, and the dangerous levels that have put us over the safe margins, if those levels of CO2 get into the ocean, which they will, it's just a matter of time, well, then you can't pull it out of the ocean. Once it's in there, it takes about 1,000 years to cycle around, because the ocean's so deep, and the currents, and to cycle all of that around, turn all of that around, is about 1,000 years. So we don't really feel the full effects of global warming until that's completely cycled around. So what we're experiencing right now is the very, very tip of the iceberg. And it's also a very, very urgent time because we have a very short window of time to get these emissions out of the air and put them back in the soil where they're sequestered and where they belong. That's where they came from. And this is all done through photosynthesis and all kinds of things. And if we can do that, these emissions will not end up in the ocean where there's nothing we can do once they're there.
You've already won a ton of awards for this film. It came out last year in 2014. Talk a little bit about that. It must be quite gratifying.
Well, obviously, it's so fun to win awards, and it's always such an honor to win an award. There are so many good films out there, which it's, you know, been a great privilege to go to these film festivals because, like you were saying earlier, it's not always that easy to see these really good films if they don't get broadcast right away. Well, a lot of them do end up on online platforms, but, you know, it isn't that easy to see these films. And when you go to these film festivals, it's just, you know, you're hungry for them. And I find that the public is hungry for them, too. And there are really a lot of great ones out there. And so when winning awards, you know, it feels great. And it's really important for films, too, because it helps them catch the attention, you know, of the public, and the more that happens, the more likely they are to be broadcasted so that everybody could see them.
Just so folks know, this film is going to be shown Saturday, March 7th at 11 a.m. at the Chicago Cultural Center, as we've mentioned in the interview I'm doing with the folks from the One Earth Film Festival. There are events all over the city of Chicago. It's rapidly expanding, kind of like the Big Bang. It will be at the Claudia Cassidy Theater. That's at 77 East Randolph Street, Chicago, 11 a.m. Saturday, March 7th. There's also a pre-event screening Tuesday, March 3rd, from 12 p.m. and 7 p.m. at Classic Cinemas Lake Theater at 1022 Lake Street in Oak Park. So there are several opportunities to see Angel Azul. Marcy, are you a diver yourself?
Well, that's kind of a funny thing. No, I took a diving. I got certified because I was sort of delusional and thought that I would be the one doing the underwater filming because I am a photographer and I do most of my own filmmaking shooting. So I went through the whole course and all, but I had no idea how difficult it was to dive and shoot at the same time if you aren't a very experienced diver. So I did not do the underwater photography. The underwater photography was done by the artist himself, Jason DeCaris Taylor. And when he was in the footage, then somebody else had to be filming him, you know, like when he was deploying statues or something and I needed him to be in frame. Then Mario Sanchez Navarro did that, gathered that film footage for me. So, yes, I do have a diving certificate, but I would not call myself a real diver. I wished I would have had more time to have gotten good at that, but, you know, it's quite a skill, and especially if you're trying to do something else at the same time, it starts to get to be kind of dangerous because I was not paying attention to the diving part of it, as I was more focused on the photography part of it.
And so you actually
important things like how much air I had left.
So you actually started. You tried this. You thought you were going to be able to pull this off, but
yeah, I did. It was completely not sensible. But the good news is I got to go in and see the statues and everything. So you know, I'm really glad that I did go through the whole experience. It helped me gain an understanding and appreciation for the experience of diving and what divers accomplish. And if I have another opportunity to get better at it, I think I would definitely seize that opportunity.
What they accomplish, especially if they have a camera in their hands. And as you said, I don't know if you probably didn't mean it this way. You're probably using jargon from the business, but you said when, you know, you needed to have Jason in frame. I'm reminded of times when I'm alone at an event, and I will hand my cell phone or my camera to, you know, usually if I'm speaking to a crowd and I want to get a couple of pics of it, I say, anybody good with a camera here in the room? And usually somebody's hand goes up, and usually they're awful. They're just awful with the camera. It's like nothing's in frame, everything's out of focus, and you just say, okay, if that's a person who's good with a camera, wow, I can't imagine what the rest of you are like.
I've been in that same situation.
I know it's really, it can be really frustrating because, you know, I don't know about you, but often I mean, I don't have a posse. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
It's just, you know, that's what I would suspect that most directors of documentaries do not have posses.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You're right.
how many films have you done?
This was my first environmental film. Before that, I had made one ArtiDoc, feature-length ArtiDoc. Now, an ArtiDoc was something that another film student and I had come up with. In fact, it was her idea, and we were making these short little documentaries on artists, and most of the time they were short. We did do one feature-length one on a jazz singer, and when I set out to do this film, Angel Azul, I was following along the same lines of wanting to document the artist. I was very, of course, you know, enamored with these statues, and the whole concept of putting them on the ocean floor was just completely, you know, exciting to me. And that was going to be the whole film, which it could have been. There was definitely enough there that I could have made a whole ArtiDoc on that. But what ended up happening was midway through the filming, the coral on the statue started to die. And when I started asking questions about that, it became quite clear that they had a problem and that they weren't really openly dealing with the problem. So I brought scientists in, like Dr. Garreau and Dr. Sylvia Earle, to sort of explain what was going on, and that put it in context with all of the rest of the coral reefs around the world and opened my eyes to the problem that's going on everywhere. And before you know it, it was a full-fledged environmental documentary. So I haven't really made another one before. I'm now sort of, I found this niche, and the next film I'm making, Dirt Rich, is also an environmental documentary. I really haven't made very many films.
Unbelievable. There you go. You know, out of the gate, and you're scooping up awards left and right. And with any luck, changing the way people think about these things, especially the idea of going to this park, and this is an oceanic park, right?
Right. It's a marine park. Yeah.
Park, where folks can they can dive and they can see coral, and now they can see art. They can see the statues. You know, it was I think we were about 10, 15, maybe 20 minutes into the film, and I started screaming at the television. What are these things made of? What are they made of? You know, thank you very much. You answered the question, but that was on my mind as I was watching it. It's like, okay, if you're trying to recreate what's in the ocean, don't you have to pay attention to the substance? And if you want coral to live on these pieces of sculpture that are sitting in the bottom of the sea, you have to have the right materials.
Right. Absolutely. It's funny, that was my reaction too when I first saw them. My first worry was, well, is this toxic? Is this okay? And, you know, I had a little trouble getting used to the idea until I found out that indeed they are eco-friendly. They're made from an eco-friendly cement that mimics rock, and, you know, it's all fair and good. But I still had to sort of ask myself how I felt about putting man-made things down on the ocean floor. And then I thought to myself, you know, we put things in the ocean every day that pollute the ocean every day, like boats and ships and oil rigs and
plastic bottles and cans and junk.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and here we're putting in something that mimics rock, allows the marine life to grow, aggregates fish, you know, it has all of these other added benefits to them, too, and is not toxic and is in a place where it's not going to, you know, pose any danger or create any kind of environmental impact or anything like that. And I realized that I wasn't, you know, I was fine with it. It took me a while because my impulse was to react to that, but then I realized after some thinking that I was really, really fine with it. In fact, I felt that it was really a great gift to everybody because it helped open eyes to mainstream viewers that might not have thought about these issues before. You know, that's one of the things when you're making an environmental documentary. So often these documentaries have their crowd, their choir, that, you know, it's really easy to preach to the choir, and we need our choir. We need our that backing to help us launch our films and people that already have an appreciation and understanding. But the real challenge is to pull in the mainstream viewer who may not, you know, necessarily think about these things, and the environment may not be on the top of their mind. And the gift of these statues allowed me to do that. You know, it allowed me to sort of lure people in, and just the way I was lured in, and then, you know, and then learn something. Mm-hmm. So I'm very grateful to Jason because, you know, he came up with this very out-of-the-box idea, which I think is something now in this day and age with the challenges we have in front of us, we really need to be thinking out of the box. And Jason was just a huge example of that for me, and I'm really grateful to him for doing that because it pulled me in, and, you know, I realized that anybody could be pulled in by these statues. You know, they're really interesting, and they're mm-hmm. really beautiful. And,
yeah.
You know.
And the next time somebody says to you, what good is art, you just point to the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, right. I feel so strongly that artists and music, all forms of art, dance, music, all of that, literature, film, it's what makes the world go round. It's like holding up a mirror of our time and place right now here on the planet, and it reflects back our issues, our joys, our sorrows, are, you know, it's so necessary because it helps us take a look at what's going on rather than just continue on with life as if nothing else was happening. So I really feel strongly that art is super important as for us as human beings to have as a gauge for what we are, how we are on the planet at this time, you know, in history. And in before, too, you know, you look back, and I mean, how we find out a lot about what it was like before us. You know, we look at art, we read, we hear the music of the time, we see the dance of the time. You know, it tells us a great deal. I just think it's great.
Well, folks should know, again, that this film, Angel Azul, will be shown several times as part of the One Earth Film Festival. The main showing Saturday, March 7th, 11 a.m. at the Chicago Cultural Center in the Claudia Cassidy Theater, 77 East Randolph Street. Before that, a pre-event screening Tuesday, March 3rd at 12 p.m. and 7 p.m. at Classic Cinema's Lake Theater. That's at 1022 Lake Street in Oak Park. Do we need to give Kath Delaney a shout-out here as well?
Kath Delaney and Eric Johnson were both the fundraising producers on the film and helped with the, you know, trying to raise funds to pay for the film. And they definitely deserve a shout out for that effort. That was a very difficult thing to try to do. Fundraising is always a hard part, you know, making a film. They came on board after the film was made, and we were trying to, you know, pay back our budget kind of thing. And we were, you know, reaching out to organizations, foundations, and online fundraising, and it was a big, big effort, and definitely a shout out for that.
All right. Well, Marcy Cravat, it's been a delight talking to you. When you do your new film, now you have to contact me. and make sure I know when it's coming out so I can...
Okay, definitely. I'm starting on it now, and, you know, little by little, I think probably in about a year and a half, we should have a film.
Okay, I'll be waiting. I'll be hanging around.
Well, I will definitely let you know.
And can I say this? I understand. Are you going to Russia? Is that what I hear?
Yeah. In fact, I'm leaving tomorrow morning for a film festival in Russia. I can't even believe it. And then I'm returning to two more. And so it's going to be a busy few weeks coming up here. And it's going to be quite an experience going to Russia. We're going to be in Moscow. We're actually opening the festival. Angel is opening the festival. And then we spend a few days in Moscow, and then we go to St. Petersburg. And, I mean, how exciting. I've never would have imagined that I'd be going to Russia.
Well, say hi to Putin for me, okay, while you're there, all right? tell him to keep his shirt on. And tell him to leave Ukraine alone while he's at it, okay? Would you please?
Yeah, right.
I know you're gonna deliver the message for me. All right, Marcy, thank you so much. Have a safe trip.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about all this. It's really important stuff, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
It's my pleasure. Okay, let's get back to my conversation with Cassandra West, Gina Robbins, and David Holmquist about the rest of the One Earth Film Festival. Take it away, Bobby Darin.
Happy we'll be beyond the sea. Never again, I'll go say.
Almost every year we've had at least one or two films where it's following an artist who's trying to convey an environmental message. And I think that that is a very compelling way of sending this message. So.
Okay.
The people who do this sort of thing their personal stories are compelling too. I mean, they're just really interesting people.
Do you mean the directors?
No, I mean the artists.
Particularly. Oh, the artists. If there are
the directors too, but the artists in particular really make their life stories make compelling film.
David, tell me about another film that you were moved by.
One that I push particularly hard for is a climate change science film, it's called Thin Ice. It features one scientist from the University of Chicago and a number of scientists from around the world. And what I found compelling about it was that it showed the scientists at work. It wasn't a documentary that showed you lots of charts and graphs and kind of hammered you with the science. It did a little of that, but it showed the scientists at work on ships, at sea, in the Antarctic, drilling ice cores and going through the process of staking claim to pieces of the ice cores that they were then going to analyze. Large groups, small groups, men, women, scruffy guys with beards.
Aren't all scientists scruffy guys with beards?
No, that's not the image that I had going in. I mean, these were really workaday people, and their dedication to their work, I thought, was really compelling. So it was just a different way of looking at it. And in addition to that, I'm a climate activist, and I thought I knew the science pretty well. But I learned quite a lot from that film about paleoclimatology, mm-hmm. The study of climate going back 35 million years, that's being modeled now, particularly by a scientist who used to be at Purdue, and some of the uncertainties that they're becoming able to resolve now around climate, which it's new information that I think people will be really interested in seeing.
And the name of this film again is?
It's called Thin Ice, and it'll be showing on the evening of Saturday, which is March 7th, at University of Chicago, at the Logan Center at the University of Chicago.
Okay. Cassandra, your turn.
One of the things I'm concerned about is our food system, and I was drawn to this film called Just Eat It, which was, as I said, shown last night at Loyola. So it was a pre-fest event, and it's also going to be part of the festival Sunday, March 8th at the Oak Park Library, and it deals with food waste, and that's, again, getting back to something that is part of our daily existence but that we don't pay attention to. We all waste food. 40% of the food that gets produced in this country gets wasted. It goes into landfills, you know, and so food that goes into landfills creates methane gas, which, you know, is a harmful gas in the environment. So there are a lot of aspects of that film that connect to the way we live. And I think food rescue is another aspect that the film talks about, how food can be rescued. I've been involved with working with the local food pantry, and we do food rescues there. And so I think letting people know that you don't have to throw out food just because an expiration date or a sell-by date has come upon you. You can, somebody can still benefit from it and eat it. So food is a critical issue. Edible City is another film that deals with community gardens and growing food.
I noticed that, and we talked about this before, that From Billions to None is part of the festival. I happen to be the narrator on that mm-hmm. film, and Joel Greenberg and David Mrazek have been on my radio show to talk about it. So that is about the passenger pigeon and the extinction of the passenger pigeon. And you're going to find that fascinating, too, if you haven't seen that. And a lot of people have a vague idea of what the passenger pigeon was. But it's, you know, it's important to know that there were billions of them in America up until the late 19th century, and then we killed them off. I mean, we slaughtered them like nobody's business. It might have been the most numerous bird in North America, perhaps the world, and bam, in a matter of a few decades, nothing, gone. One of the films that you have on your list is called No Land, No Food, No Life, and is that, that's a premiere, from what I understand?
Yes, yes. We're very excited to have this film. It's we actually have two films by this director, Amy Miller, from Canada. Her first film, The Carbon Rush, is screening as well, but No Land, No Food, No Life is her newer film, and this is the U.S. premiere, actually. So this is the first time it'll be screened in the U.S., so we're really excited about that. It's a global story about what happens to the food systems worldwide and how that's impacting vulnerable populations, and very excited to have that film. That one is screening at the Institute of Cultural Affairs in Chicago at 11 o'clock on Saturday morning, March 7th. Trash Dance is a very interesting film as well. It also has an art component. This is the story of a choreographer in Austin, Texas, who choreographs with unusual subjects. So in this case, she has taken the whole waste management system of Austin, Texas, and choreographed a dance with them. So she spends several months riding around on garbage trucks, riding around on the roadkill collection trucks, recycling, you know, back in the home office system, all of that. And she studies their movement, what they're doing when they're scooping stuff up, when they're dumping stuff. She mm-hmm. studies the movement of the trucks. And in the end, all of these workers participate in the dance. The trucks participate in the dance. So it's educational in that you learn about the whole system and what's involved in the waste system. It's empowering for these waste management employees. So I'm very excited that that film's going to be screening. And as part of it, it's going to be screening at Columbia College on March 7th. And as part of that program, the Columbia College Dance Department is going to put together some unique choreography for a 10-minute performance prior to the screening. So,
And you said there was no entertainment here. This is, you talk about entertainment. That's entertainment.
Yeah, it's very entertainment, and it's a very compelling story and very educational. So it has, there's countless films here that have all of those things and the programming involved. So
pick one out, David, that you like.
Another one that I was particularly impressed with is called Symphony of the Soil. It's showing at 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon, that would be March 8th, at Triton College. And it's a long film, but I still recommend that people come see it.
Okay, what your definition of long?
Well, it's about 100 minutes, a little over 100 minutes. So it's about as long as a feature-length film. Most of these are a little bit shorter. But this one is, first of all, it's a beautiful film. It has great, Symphony of the Soil has great music to go along with the visuals. But it's about soil science and draws together connections between soil and our food system, clean water, climate change, how soil affects the entire biosphere and has a role to play in many of the sustainability issues that are featured in other films in the festival. I won't say that it draws the festival together, but it does draw together quite a few of the themes, the sustainability themes that concern people these days. And as I say, it's a gorgeous film.
Well, we do have three short films, Brooklyn Farmer, Lexicon of Sustainability, and Portrait of an Urban Beekeeper.
And are those all showing together?
They will be showing together Sunday, March 8th at 12:30 p.m. at the Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, which is here in Oak Park, 611 Randolph Street. And there will be refreshments and a honey tasting to go along with the Portrait of an Urban Beekeeper.
All right. Anything else that you want to throw into the mix here?
Well, I wanted to go back to the Angel Azul film. That inspired another component of this year's film festival. We have a tourable art exhibit where we asked, and Gina was involved with this, asking local artists to create pieces of art from found and recycled material, and that's called the Love One Earth art exhibit. And we have about six artists who've made works from toilet paper rolls to
found metal,
bottles,
old jeans, all sorts of things. Yeah.
And where are those going to be on display?
They went on display on Valentine's Day. The Love One Earth is, you know, get it, love, Valentine's Day. And they're shown at local businesses around Oak Park. Green Home Experts is one, Trattoria 225, which is a restaurant.
Ahimsa Yoga Studio. Just numerous different businesses, and they can all be found on our website.
And one other part of the festival this year is the chance for festival attendees to vote on a film that they think would be worth showing at the City of Chicago's Earth Day activities. And that's going to be called the One Earth Day Film. So people who come to films can vote on a film, go online and vote. And the top three films will be screened by a jury of about five people. And then they will select the film that can be shown to a general audience on Earth Day, which is in April. And that's, we're working with the City of Chicago's Sustainability Department to bring that.
By the way, that's Cassandra West. I'm talking to Gina Robbins and David Holmquist in addition. And you mentioned the website, which is oneearthfilmfest.org, in case people want to check this out. I should mention again, this is the One Earth Film Festival 2015. More than 35 films in more than 30 locations throughout Chicago. As you mentioned, it's spreading all over the place. it's like a fungus. And audience discussions following each film. That's quite a commitment.
Programming is huge, and we think it's important for people to not just come and watch a film and then get up and walk out. We want to have partners who bring literature, information, so that people can take action. This is not just about coming and sitting for a few hours and watching a film. It's about being a part of the world and taking an active role in solving some of the problems that these films bring to light.
And as you mentioned in your literature, you've got films for the whole family. In this. Are there specifically kids' films in the festival?
Well, every year since we've started this, we spend, I think it's a Saturday or Sunday morning, where a school will host a family-oriented or family-friendly film showing. And so certainly those films are targeted or geared toward children from anywhere 5 years on up to middle school. And we also, since we've been doing this, we've had a young filmmakers contest. So we invite elementary, middle school, high school, and college students to submit 3 to 8 minute environmentally oriented films that offer solutions. And I happen to be a judge this year for those films. I just finished screening 9 films we had, and so we'll be announcing the winners in those categories soon.
And I assume it'll be on the website. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's interesting, as you mentioned it earlier, it doesn't, in the 21st century, certainly in 2015, I mean, we're all carrying phones that you could make films from. And really, these days, it's not so much about the money, it's about the ideas. Who, you know, are you? What moves you? How creative can you be? Because it's not as prohibitive right. as it used to be. So I'm glad that you have the high schoolers involved in putting those films together. Yeah. So you're just a bunch of tree-hugging do-gooders, right? Is
exactly.
that it?
Yeah,
it's like... Yeah.
Proud tree huggers.
Yeesh.
And it should be said, too, that the majority of the screenings are free of charge. So donations are accepted, but for the most part, there's very few that have a required admission charge.
I think that's really actually a very important point.
Yes,
that
yes.
the screenings are basically
yes,
free. But,
yes.
I mean, it doesn't hurt if you drop $5 in the...
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
There is a suggested donation, but...
Most of these films have... licensing fees and, you know, so the donations and sponsorships will go towards those kinds of costs.
You asked, what have we missed? So I want to put in a plug for the Green Carpet Gala.
Okay.
Which is starts at 6:30 on Friday, March the 6th. It's at Film Row Cinema at Columbia College, which is at 1104 South Wabash on the 8th floor. And that's our festival kickoff event. So there's food, drink, people will mingle, and there's always a guest speaker. And usually we show a short film or clips from other films that will be shown in the festival during the weekend. And we end, generally, again this year, our closing celebration will be at Unity Temple in Oak Park. And that starts at 6:30 on Sunday, March 8th.
Okay. Well, folks, thank you so much for doing this work and gathering these films and for sitting down with me today. And let's rock and roll. Let's get a bunch of people in there. And
thank you for helping us to get the word out.
Yes, yeah. Thank you.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
You can get more information at mikenowak.net, MikeNowak.net, for links, photos, and commentary.